This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and it is Friday, which means it's time for the Week in Review. And we'll start with new revelations about astonishing misconduct by a former state drug lab chemist.
In drug cases, the principal evidence is the drugs.
Right.
And if you can't trust that test, then what else are you going to trust?
The report from Attorney General Maura Healey's office finds that Amherst chemist Sonia Farak consumed drugs from the lab almost every day for 8 years. She stole from the lab's stock of drugs as well as from evidence that she was supposed to be testing.
When you try to run a drug war on the cheap, there are consequences for it, and we're now in a position where the chickens have kind of come home to roost.
Well, there is much to discuss on this topic, and joining us to do so is Charlie Chibio. He's a senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and a research fellow at the Ash Center at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Charlie, good to see you again.
Good to see you. Thanks.
Also with us is Shira Springer, investigative reporter for the sports section of the Boston Globe. Shira, great to have you back as well.
Good to be here.
So first of all, let me just get quickly from both of you first reactions on this drug lab story, the second case. Yet another investigation to another chemist and enormous misconduct. Charlie, your thoughts?
Well, it just, I'm no expert on how these things work, but it just astonishes me that there aren't procedures in place that they don't know where every drug sample that they have is all the time and have it cataloged. It just boggles my mind how this can happen. And mm-hmm. and the results of it, it's like waves and waves upon waves, that happen as a result of these kind of screw-ups.
I mean, when we talk about waves upon waves, we're talking tens of thousands of potential
right.
cases affected. Some possibly they're saying 30, possibly maybe even 40,000 cases. Shira?
Yeah, I think the thing that staggered me was the number of years that this went on.
Yes.
And I think it was an interim report that said that the chemist in question was under the influence of controlled substances during a vast majority of her working hours from the last quarter of 2004 mm-hmm. until a removal from the lab in January 2013. I mean, that is absolutely unbelievable that none of her coworkers were noticing anything unusual about her performance or her appearance or the way she kept her workspace until the last few months, according to the Attorney General's report. I mean, I just cannot believe that nobody in that lab noticed something during a 7 or 8 year period about this chemist and didn't think to report it.
And
it's
they said
staggering.
That she testified in court while under the influence.
While under the influence.
And, she has said in her grand jury testimony that she was under the influence when there was a state inspection of the lab the inspection was designed to enhance the accreditation of the lab. Mm-hmm. So there were people coming in and inspecting the lab, and she was under the influence.
I mean, the scale of the misconduct really is astonishing. All those things that we just mentioned, also that she was possibly even manufacturing
crack
drugs
cocaine.
In the lab.
Manufacturing crack cocaine.
And the one that really gets me is that she affected or changed or tampered with the standard that the lab uses to measure the evidence that comes into the lab. So you have a pure standard of a drug. That's how you measure, what percentage of cocaine or whatever is in the evidence that comes in. So that means, who knows how many other chemists use those altered standards? So
right.
it just keeps going on and on and on. And it returns us to that question, Charlie, that you were asking that both of you asking us, how could this have gone on so long without anybody noticing? There are some prosecutors now that have concerns that maybe, depending on what the fallout is for these tens of thousands of cases, that if some people end up getting released, we could have some violent criminals getting released.
Violent criminals getting released, all kinds of public safety issues, not to mention the amount of money it's going to take to have to sort of retry a bunch of people and just get to the bottom of this whole thing in terms of who was affected and who wasn't. It's really endless.
But on the other hand, Shira, I'm going to get back to you in just a second. I also want to present, though, this view from retired federal judge Nancy Gertner, who spoke with us a little earlier this week. And basically, she said that she believes there's really only one way to fix the problem regarding all the cases that could have been tainted by this chemist.
This is not how do we, determine what's legitimate in the midst of this morass. These are cases that simply need to be dismissed, and that's what the court should do.
Shira, what's your thought on that?
I think she's right, and I think also she has made the point, Judge Gertner has made the point, that maybe we should think a little bit broader about whether we prosecute for small quantities. Maybe we need to rethink the war on drugs. And I think that's another issue that needs to be raised, because I think what's evident with what happened here is that this lab and this chemist and her coworkers were clearly overwhelmed and dealing with a very small budget, because part of the report also deals with how they had to make do. They had to manufacture some of those standards in the lab because they didn't have enough money in their budget to buy those standards from accredited sources. Mm-hmm. So I think there are budget issues here. There are security issues here. There are oversight issues here that stem from an underfunded system or perhaps an overtaxed system. And we maybe need to rethink the way we go about fighting the quote-unquote war on drugs.
And I think that was also part of Annie Ducan's motivation,
right. Mm-hmm.
You know, that she needed to make her quotas and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So
yeah, well, so speaking of Annie Ducan, we should just remind everyone that, you know, she was the first that came under scrutiny. Now right. We have Sonia Farak, so two, at least. It makes me wonder if there are any more.
It's a systematic problem. Issue.
Yeah, and after the Annie Ducan case broke, the state police took over the state crime lab, which had been run by the Department of Public Health prior to that. And the remaining labs have all been accredited now. We have a little bit of tape from Governor Baker speaking at an event that was a bit windy, but it's worth trying to listen to what he said through the wind, because he said that the state police have done a great deal to improve protocols at the state crime labs.
But we certainly believe we're going to have a big responsibility to work with the courts and with others to make sure that people who are affected by this have the appropriate opportunity to engage that conversation. And we fully expect we're going to be doing that for the next several months.
Does that mean putting resources aside?
We're certainly going to have to put resources into this because a lot of cases are affected by it, yeah.
Not entirely clear exactly what those resources are just yet. But Shira, I mean, going forward, what would you like to see from the Baker administration or from the state as a whole? I mean, obviously, we got to fix this problem, but specifically?
I think, well, first of all, greater oversight. I mean, I think there needs to be either some third-party inspection or somebody outside of the workplace that comes in on a regular basis and looks at the work that these chemists are doing, because if this chemist's supervisor did not recognize that this was a woman under the influence, something is very wrong there. I mean, early on in her career, he was writing reports that she was meticulous and dedicated to her work. Meanwhile, she was manufacturing drugs on the side in that very lab.
Yeah.
I think that's one thing. Another thing that came out in the report that I read was just the security of the lab in general. Apparently, this operated on the UMass Amherst campus or one of their buildings, and students could come in and out of the building. There was no cataloging with the ID cards of who was accessing the lab. You just simply swiped your card. So I think better tracking of employees, better tracking of who accesses the lab, who accesses the lab buildings. I mean, some very fundamental or elemental security measures should be undertaken in addition to some greater oversight. It will all come at a cost, but you have to make the determination. Either you want to pay now or you pay later.
Well, yeah,
with overturned
convictions. And through the whole process, if the state doesn't pay to get its act in order, you know that there are people in the criminal justice system who may be paying with their lives the way the law is set up. But
right.
Or the public may be paying down the
right.
road with
the cost. Exactly.
Or the overturned convictions that let out potentially some violent
yes,
criminals.
Paying in many different ways.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Charlie,
exactly.
Go ahead.
No, you know, this is absolutely true. And to me, this just puts a spotlight again on one of the fundamental issues that we have in government, no matter who's the governor, no matter who's the speaker, all these kind of things, is that it's so easy in government to just sort of not pay attention to these things and to underfund them and to assume that nothing will break on your watch. And, you know, this, God knows how many other of these kind of just
well, doesn't
it
remind
bombs.
You of Department of Family Services
right.
in some
yeah,
ways,
yeah,
too, where you
yeah,
sort of push the
exactly.
problem aside until you have a really heartbreaking case that comes up with a child that's killed, and then you begin
yeah,
to realize you have to deal with a systematic issue.
With everything from DCF to the T, you know,
mm-hmm,
in the last
exactly.
couple of years, you know.
Well,
you can't push the can down the
right.
road, because if you do...
Right.
The can eventually gets crushed, I guess.
Or the people do.
The people do. Well, let's move on. This is kind of a week of some somber news, so let's just move on to another one, and that is this week we got a clearer picture of just how awful the opioid epidemic has become in Massachusetts. More than 1,300 people died in Massachusetts just last year because of opioid overdoses. More than half of those deaths involved the powerful painkiller fentanyl. So here's some tape of reaction from Health and Human Services Secretary Mary Lou Sutters.
It is going to be multi-pronged, multi-year to really bend the trend of opioid deaths in the Commonwealth. I wish I could say, you know, we have crested this, but I don't believe we have.
Charlie, let me start with you. What would you make of those numbers?
Well, you know, and the amazing thing about those numbers is that it sounds like, if you look into it, that they may even be adjusted higher as
right.
the medical examinations and everything finally come in. I think this is absolutely true, and I think this highlights another issue that I really worry about, that, again, whether it's the T or the opioid epidemic, we are faced with a lot of problems that are going to take a very long time to fix. And I really wonder about voters' ability to be patient and to stay focused on these things over the period of time it's going to take to solve issues that are this deeply entrenched.
You know, I mean, maybe it's because of that we will be able to stay focused on this issue, because, I mean, the number was double last year that it was just a couple of years ago, meaning
amazing.
Twice as many families, twice as many friends, twice as many loved ones. And as you said, it doesn't really show any signs of abating. So sadly, because of the upward trajectory, that might be exactly the thing, because it's affecting more and more people, Shira.
Yeah,
keeps us focused on this problem.
Yeah, you gave the number of 1,300, but Charlie said that number may go up. I'm hearing now it could be, you know, around 1,500 when all of the calculations and medical examinations are completed and done and official. Either number is obviously way too high. But what I think is interesting, when they're putting these numbers, they're putting a lot of demographic research behind these numbers now. So we're beginning to figure out better who's affected, how they're affected, what type of opioid they're taking, you know, whether it's fentanyl or other opioid-related drugs. And I think, you know, when they talk about a multi-pronged approach, that will help them. That kind of data, it may have to be something of a data-driven multi-pronged
approach. Let me just jump
approach.
In here, Shira, because the point you're bringing up is exactly something that the state's public health commissioner, Monica Burrell, mentioned this week. So let's listen.
The opioid deaths disproportionately impact younger people. 67% of the unintentional overdoses last year were from individuals under the age of 44. And you'll see that, again, it's also males and white males. But it's impacting everybody across all communities in Massachusetts.
You know, with that in mind, we also should just take a moment to remember that, of course, it was just 2 months ago that Governor Baker did sign his opioid law into effect, putting tighter controls on prescription painkillers, limiting those initial prescriptions to a 7-day supply, and requiring hospitals to give substance abuse evaluations to anyone in the ER that they have some concerns about. So steps being taken forward here. But, you know, in Vermont, Governor Peter Shumlin made Vermont's Governor Peter Shumlin made a really impassioned speech at a recent meeting of the American Society of Addiction Medicine. And he wants, you know, while lauding efforts such as Governor Baker's in Massachusetts, he really wants the entire nation as a whole to push forward with determination on this problem, to help reduce the 250 million opioid painkiller prescriptions that are written every year in the U.S. So here he is.
Do we have 250 million Americans in chronic pain? Is that what you guys think? Why are we asking pharma to find new ways to treat opiate addiction when we know that we could find a direct way? Stop passing out painkillers like candy, America. That's my message. That should be your message. Let's tell them to cut it out.
Charlie, your reaction to that?
Well, my reaction to that is just, you know, for people of my generation, the most telling thing there is that it's the governor of Vermont that's giving this speech. You know, it's not like in my generation we think of this as an inner city problem or a poverty problem. This is the governor of Vermont. This problem has just so deeply ingrained in the fabric of our country right now that it's just everyone. Nobody is immune from it.
Mm. Yeah, and just to go back to the demographic aspect of it, you know, Vermont has, you know, been incredibly affected. You know, rural parts of Vermont have been incredibly affected by the heroin epidemic. And I think it's going to take a lot of creative minds, a lot of health officials to figure out. There's no one solution. I think that's the tricky problem with this. Yeah. There's no one solution for, you know, what may stop or help abate opioid issues in Boston is not the same thing that will work in rural sections of Vermont, let's say. And I think you know, that when Massachusetts health officials talk about the multi-pronged approach, I mean, I don't know how many prongs there's got to be, but it seems like there might need to be dozens at this point because of all the different tentacles that this epidemic has.
When what really amazed me was when I looked at this article that Evan Horowitz wrote in The Globe, that really it's, you know, you have sort of one set of problems that tends to be younger males, you know, heroin, fentanyl, and then you've got this other set of problems of older people who tend to get hooked on this stuff as a result of
you know, painkillers.
Yes. Painkillers,
you know, hip replacements, things like that. And I wonder, given what I read today in The Globe, you know, if indeed it comes out that that might have been the case with Prince, you know, and I mean, you know, those are the kind of things that
you can't. I don't know if you can treat the, you know, the 25-year-old heroin slash fentanyl addicted person the same way you can treat the 65-year-old painkiller addicted person, and yet they may end up at the same place eventually. Exactly. And so I think that's a really difficult nut to crack for hospitals.
Well, I want to leave us enough time to talk about yet another story this week, and that has to do with the duck boats, because, of course, last weekend there was that awful accident or crash between a duck boat and a moped that killed 28-year-old Allison Warmuth, who was riding the moped. So we've got some tape here from attorney Bob Mongaluzzi. He represented two families in a 2010 crash in the Delaware River, and he told WBZ that the duck boats are inherently unsafe.
These are war machines, and they're used to promote tourism. But let me tell you something, you don't promote tourism by killing tourists or killing locals.
We also spoke with Northeastern's civil engineering professor Peter Firth, and he told us that, yes, there's a giant blind spot around the front end of a duck boat that makes it really hard for the drivers to see people and folks on mopeds, but that he believes that there are very doable fixes, cameras, audible alarms, that kind of thing, when the duck boats are on city streets.
It's meaningful for tourism, for Boston Pride. You know, the duck boats, they add something to us. We shouldn't have to choose between culture and safety. We should be able to have both.
Sherry, you think it's possible to have both?
I think it is possible. And you're talking to someone who rode on a duck boat tour with my two nephews exactly 2 weeks ago and had a great time. You're also talking to a runner who regularly crosses paths with duck boats. And I will tell you this, if we are at an intersection, I make sure I catch that driver's attention before I go in front of that duck boat. I am waving my hand up high and saying, hey, because I know it, you can tell from where you are on the ground that they cannot see you. Yeah. So I think, you know, there are solutions out there. There was that incredible, horrific accident in Seattle, I believe.
Five people were killed.
Exactly.
In that accident.
Five people were killed.
Many more injured.
50 people injured. Yeah.
Exactly. Yes. And after that, there were much tougher regulations in that city, including what they called paired tours. So you have one person driving the duck boat and another person narrating the tour. I think that's a possibility to look at. I also think, you know, we have cameras now in our cars when we back up. Why can't there be some sort of visual assistance for duck boats now?
Charlie, jump in here.
Yeah, no, all of that is true. Plus, you know, in preparing for this, I came across a company called Super Duck Boats in Boston that apparently use vehicles that have a much shorter bow in front, and so that they have a much smaller blind spot, and indeed they have one person who just drives and one person who narrates, which seems to me to just be common sense.
You know, before we leave this topic, we also have to mention that the driver of the duck boat himself had a history of moving violations, including 10 speeding citations, 3 seatbelt violations, and he was found to be at fault in a 2003 accident, and he was also required to take a driver retraining class in 2004. So there's this whole other issue of, you know, I presume that there should be pretty strong vetting already in place
for
drivers of the duck boats, because they have to have some kind of specialized license to drive it. So what happened there, and should the vetting be even more stringent?
Yes, it should. It should be. If you have somebody with, you know, 10 speeding citations in 10 years and another violation, absolutely. And I'm curious to know how the duck boat company is going to defend this, how this guy with this driving record got past whatever vetting they're doing.
The way they're going to defend it, apparently, and whether it's just a defense or whether it's true, I don't know.
They didn't see the same records.
Well, they're saying yeah, that what they got is not the same as what DMV
has. The RMV, well, so then obviously there's got to be
better research on the part of the duck boat company.
Okay, so more to cover there as time goes by, but we've got just enough time for our hubbubs. I mean, this was a really heavy week of news, so let's lighten the mood a little bit if we can. So Shira, Hit me with your hubbub.
So nearly a year after the Boston 2024 bid collapsed under the weight of public criticism, and a week after IndyCar abandoned its Labor Day race here, comes word that the Olympians are coming to the Common. And what is going to happen on June 18th is a street meet that will take place on Charles Street between Boston Common and the Public Garden. And it will feature some of the world's top sprinters, hurdlers, long jumpers, and pole vaulters. And it's sort of, in some ways, a rebuttal to the culture of no in Boston. Yes, we can host a major international sporting event. But more than that, I think it's evidence that when you put the right event together with the right planning, with the right vision, it's something that people will welcome. I think this is going to be a fantastic event. I think there's going to be a huge turnout. It's going to give people an opportunity to really mingle with athletes they're going to see at the Rio Olympics. And it's happening here, and it's something Boston can be proud of.
It's so much more fitting to the scale.
Exactly.
Of the city, you know?
It's a 180-meter track that will run down Charles Street. You're going to get up close and personal. It's not a multi-day event. It's a small, limited size. It may grow from here, but they're starting at the right scale for this city.
Charlie, am I hearing you that you don't think that a Formula One vehicle of people going 220 miles an hour is appropriate for the Seaport?
Well, I wasn't going to be the first in line to go down and see it. Let's just say that.
Well, I'm going to actually go next with my hubbub. I love the idea of the street meet. Remind me when it's going to happen, by the way.
It's going to happen June 18th. If you all want, there's a distance festival, too, not to promote it, on June 17th at Dilboy Stadium in Somerville. So, again, they're using different parts of the city and the different parts of the area, which is nice too.
Well, my hubbub is a very different one, and I just want to actually—it's not news except for the folks here at WBUR. Our longtime receptionist Pauline, who sits at the front desk and welcomes all our guests
She's wonderful,
and
she watches
our employees
lots of cooking
in every day. she is the face of WBUR to everyone who comes and visits us. She's been here for 15 years. Today is her last day. She is retiring from WBUR and is going to spend more time with her family, and she's got beautiful grandkids, and she's going to be a grandma to them on a daily basis now, rather than being here and kind of being mother to us all at WBUR. We will miss her so very much. You know how businesses always worry about client facing to be sure we're putting our best face forward? By definition, Pauline is our client facing person, and she is the best face of WBUR, and we will miss her at the front desk. So, Pauline, love you, miss you, and wish you the best of luck to you and your family and everything else that you do. That's my hubbub.
She may actually be the first person ever to be leaving to spend more time with her family.
Legitimately, yes.
and I can't think of anyone who deserves it more. So, Pauline, love you. All right, Charlie, you get to wrap us up today.
Well, I wrap up with the fact that this week the Rolling Stones joined a long list. Steve Tyler, Neil Young, Michael Stipe from R.E.M., Adele, saying no mas. They don't want their music played at Donald Trump rallies. There's a long and glorious history of this. Bruce Springsteen didn't want Born in the USA played in 1984 at Ronald Reagan rallies. Tom Petty a few years ago decided he would not have American Girl played at Michelle Bachmann rallies. For a baby boomer like Donald Trump, there could be nothing worse than being called out publicly by Mick and Keith.
You'd think they'd ask permission first,
yeah,
though. You know? You'd think they'd clear
it
first if they could.
Well, since we are not a Donald Trump rally, we are a legit news organization. Gentlemen? Charlie Chippio is a senior fellow. Wow, that's really loud, guys, at the Pioneer Institute.
Should be loud.
Rock and roll.
And a research fellow at the Ash Center at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Great to have you as always, Charlie.
Thanks so much.
And Shira Springer, investigative reporter for the sports section of the Boston Globe. Thanks so much, Shira.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be back in a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.